Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and PRSA Silicon Valley program. The program is News 2.0, Predicting the Future of Media, and it's brought to you from Michaels in Mountain View, and my name is Steve Wright. It's my pleasure to introduce our moderator, Sam Whitmore. Sam is the founder of Sam Whitmore's Media Survey. A former media columnist at Forbes, Sam also spent 14 years with Ziff Davis Publishing in a variety of roles, including editor-in-chief. Without further ado, here's Sam.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Steve. For those in Mountain View, thank you so much. We promise to deliver great value. And a special welcome to everybody listening on the radio. So now the panelists will introduce themselves, starting with Lewis.
Hi, I'm Lewis Friedberg, a director of California Watch. California Watch is a new venture based in Berkeley, but it's going to have a statewide reach. It's a division of the Center for Investigative Reporting, and the idea is to cover critical issues in California in a way that will engage people and have an impact on public policy.
I'm Owen Thomas. I'm the online editorial director for NBC Bay Area. So I oversee NBCBayArea.com, and which is NBC's local site for the Bay Area. Previously, I ran ValleyWag for Gawker Media.
I'm Quentin Hardy. I'm the national editor for Forbes Media. Forbes Media is a consolidation of the website and the Forbes magazine and several other properties. This means that I speak at Forbes gatherings. I do a show on Fox now in its eighth year called Forbes on Fox. I write for the magazine, do web video, and on the side I also teach at the Information School at the University of California at Berkeley.
Hi, I'm Lisa Stone. I'm one of three co-founders and CEO of BlogHer. BlogHer is the leading participatory news, information, and entertainment network for women online. We started in 2005 as a conference to answer the question, where are the women who blog? Today we reach 15 million women, and in addition to our news hub at blogher.com, we have a publishing network with 2,500 bloggers and also a conference series.
Hi, I'm Kevin Yen, Director of Strategic Partnerships at YouTube. YouTube, as you know, is an open, global, democratic platform for content owners and consumers. We strive to offer users a sense of infinite choice. With respect to news on YouTube, YouTube is privileged to have many partnerships with the top news providers, including CNN, a deal that was just announced today, AP, ABC News, BBC, Bloomberg, Reuters, and many others down the chain, including independent producers and eyewitnesses such as yourself.
Hi, I'm John Race. I'm the Chief of Bureau for the Associated Press for Northern California, Northern Nevada, and Hawaii. The AP is the world's oldest and largest news organization. On any given day, a single story may reach as many as 3 billion people worldwide. I'm as excited as you are about the panel. We had some fascinating conversations at lunch. The AP, of course, is looking to bring itself and its member newspapers into the newer platforms, something that has been widely viewed and commented upon recently.
So the title of today's panel, as you probably know, is News 2.0, Predicting the Future of Media. I would suggest to you that we ought to probably baseline what News 1.0 is or was. And for that, John Race of AP, I guess I'm going to toss it back to you if your microphone is going to accommodate you. And the AP is synonymous with news. What is today's news, and will it be the same tomorrow?
Well, the AP is known colloquially as The Wire. It was also known by Abraham Lincoln as The Wire. Because it was transmitted on the telegraph at the time. Right now, we put out about 20 million words a day. We have a video network that reaches about 600 to 700 newspapers daily. We do multimedia. We do audio on different platforms. We're moving into digital delivery. And what is news going to be tomorrow? I'm not entirely sure. I'm looking at the rise of mobile and what that's going to do to journalism. It's going to push journalism to both ends, from to the very small 130 word snippet up to other organizations that are going to take news in depth.
What keeps you up at night, John?
Oh, geez. Well, I mean, everything from I have reporters going off to the wildfires and whether or not they're going to come back alive, of course. That's really what keeps you awake at night. There are so many disruptive things happening that it would be impossible to name them. I mean, there are so many areas where if you run a news organization, you wonder, okay, what's next? What do I have to train people for? We're just training people now for video. We have a videographer in our bureau. We're also training our reporters for video. We're also training for still photographs. We are simply, like, you know, rabbits in the forest looking around to try and find out what's next, what's happening next.
Quentin Hardy, Forbes, mainstream media representative. What keeps you up at night if you were Tim Forbes?
Oh, well, if I had to run it, I'll tell you a story. Last summer, I had to hire an intern for a full-time job, and I flew out to New York, and I interviewed four or five people. They spoke Korean. They spoke Russian. They'd been published in the New York Times. They'd written bots that could scour the SEC website for the information they needed, and they all wanted a job in journalism. And I thought, well, one of them would be a lunatic outrider, but when this many smart and talented people want to be in this line of work, there is a future. Now, we don't know what it is yet, and we know that the payment model has to change. I don't think the current one will last. But, you know, as for journalism having a future at all, that wouldn't be what keeps me up at night. What would keep me up at night would be figuring out the revenue model against it.
Lisa, is this the wrong question? Maybe we should be looking at new opportunities that these disruptive technologies have afforded. I think you represent, really, one of the 21st century media successes. Should we be not as concerned about what we're leaving behind and focused more on the new opportunities?
Well, I actually think it's a golden age of communications and of editors. I think it's simply a question of who's doing the editing. So if News 1.0 was a limited group of people pushing the news out to everyone and those of us in the reading audience deciding who to trust, News 2.0 is a much larger group of people using many different kinds of printing presses to push news out, and those of us now deciding who we're going to trust all over again. I think it's a fantastic and exciting opportunity, and what we're seeing across Blogger's network is that it's a golden age also of hard news. From the time that Senators Clinton and Barack Obama announced their interest in the presidency, we saw the number of blogs written by women about politics listed on our network go from, 600 to more than 2,600.
I'd like to remind the panelists that y'all can jump in and pigpile. But when you do, at least for the first few minutes, because out of courtesy for our radio listeners, just identify yourself so that they can associate a voice with a name. The thing I worry about is the difference between editorial, traditionally defined, and content. And I think blogs and a lot of social media have been maligned, perhaps, because the sort of value of it may not be obvious, whereas a scoop or something that came from traditional news organization might not be so vague. Can you address that point, and then we'll get to Lewis.
Oh, sure. I mean, I see blogs as a technology. Blogging is a tool. It's a printing press in a different realm. And what you do with it has indicated that the cream will always also rise in the top in the blogosphere. I mean, look what we did with the printing press. We printed the Gutenberg Bible as humans, and then it was pretty quickly to page 3 in pornography. You have to be very clear that there are superb blogs out there that are written to high editorial standards, like many of the ones in our network, and then there are those that just aren't. And I think what's incredibly important for today's user is that we're finding an increased interest in organizations and groups that can help filter what's good. People want to know what the good stuff is. It's increasingly difficult. And I think that's a real opportunity for many of the news organizations on this panel.
Okay. Lewis, yes.
Yeah, that's Lewis Friedberg with California Watch. Well, I think the Israel crisis, I think journalism will survive, but I think the question is in what form is it going to survive? I think the Israel question as to who is going to do substantive reporting on critical issues in California and elsewhere around the country. I think, you know, I think it may be diluted a little bit when we look at some of the larger news outlets like the New York Times, the Washington Post, 60 Minutes. They still have pretty robust news operations with very strong reporting and investigative reporting teams. But when you start going down at a state level and a regional level, we are seeing newsrooms around the country are just being decimated. And there's been a huge outflow of talent that I think does raise questions about how our issues are going to be covered. In California, we're in the middle of this gigantic budget crisis. Everybody is covering it right now. But I think arguably for the last 5 years leading up to this crisis, there hasn't been the kind of in-depth reporting that would engage Californians and help them feel that they were somehow part of the solution. And I think that's the case in states and regions all around the country. So, you know, I think this is a moment of opportunity, but I think we don't want to be too Pollyannish about this because there is the critical issue, perhaps the central issue, of who is going to pay for this. Who is going to pay for substantive reporting that is going to engage the citizenry, which I think we'd all agree that a vibrant press is a critical aspect of our democracy.
This is...
I need to push back on something that Stone just said. The idea that we printed Gutenberg and then went straight to page 3 is pernicious nonsense. We printed Gutenberg and very quickly got into the business of translation of classical texts which promoted both the Renaissance and created the Reformation. Very many important things happened along the line in the history of print. And similarly, the idea that in the blogging world, things just kind of the cream rises to the top and the best stuff arises and misinformation doesn't get out there. Well, in an era where the death panel gets massive currency, I'm not sure that's actually true.
Well, I can disagree right back because a sweeping statement about the full spectrum of what's printed via the printing press, I think, is an accurate statement. A printing press is used to print both Bibles and pornography.
You said we went straight to page 3.
So my comment is that we have a tool here, and the question is, what are people doing with it? I think that if you look at bloggers like Talking Points Memo, if you look at organizations like the Sunlight Foundation, which are doing extraordinary coverage of healthcare policy,
I totally agree.
Let
Tools
me finish.
Go ahead.
Healthcare policy that is much beyond the kind of baloney being put out about healthcare. We're seeing in-depth and excellent coverage by blogging. And I think that's incredibly valuable.
I couldn't agree more. The work Talking Points Memo did on the Justice Department firing is a classic case in point. Tools are neutral. That really isn't a breakthrough observation. But the idea that the crowd is going to sort out the truth from fallacy has not really been proven out.
Oh, actually, I think that what I said was that there is a real interest and a thirst for editors editing and for someone to show the value of what's out there. That was my summary point.
This is Kevin. And let me step back a little bit and then maybe make a statement that we can all agree upon and actually make us feel pretty good.
So you work at a tech company, don't you?
So building on what Lisa mentioned and Quentin mentioned, so we have all these tools out there, and we should recognize that there's such a short distance from your creativity to vast exposure to getting your creative product out there. I mean, that is so awesome. If you ever had a dream where you said, I could do it better than that person, like, you can do that, whether it be a blog, right, on YouTube. For folks who dabbled in video, say, 5 years ago, you remember what a pain that was. I mean, you could not do that at home. Now, for free, within, like, 5 minutes of shooting your video, you have it up there, and you can have it promoted all across YouTube. So I don't know how, you know, it's similar to what keeps... Lewis up at night about all this talent and wanting to go into journalism. What keeps me up at night is having all this talent go to waste. And for me, when I think about all the tools out there, whether it's on YouTube or blogs or search engines, I'm very hopeful that, you know, creativity will find a home and hopefully the economic models, you know, will follow.
If I may jump in, Owen Thomas from NBC Bay Area. I used to work at a place where our posts actually were measured right on the page where the audience could see how many page views each story got. And that was a really great discipline. And I actually really enjoyed that from the get-go, because as a writer, you want to be read. As a journalist, you want your journalism to get out there. But I think that, you know, this, you know, exploring nonprofit models, that's great. We should try that. But we shouldn't give up the idea that journalism can actually pay for itself. We don't have a crisis of journalism. We have a crisis of media business models. The problem with newspapers is that they're a package of distribution that's outmoded. It's, you know, it's not that newspaper stories aren't worth reading, though actually, you know, if you live in the Bay Area, often they are. And that's something I hope to help solve at NBCBayArea.com, is to get some better journalism out there. But I think there is this crisis of confidence that's kind of crazy in journalism. Why are you all staying up at night? I don't get this. I sleep very soundly. Just get a good night's rest, wake up, do good work. You will find an audience. Also, this idea that that advertising is, you know, is not the answer. Well, we've had lots of media that have been entirely advertising supported. Look at TV, look at radio. So I think giving up on advertising is entirely wrongheaded. I've been in the Bay Area since 1995 in online media pretty much for all of that time, and I can't remember how many advertising crises we've had. I mean, the first was in 1997 when Wired published a feature called The Great Web Wipeout. And, you know, it's the same old story. It's cyclical. It's a new growing market that periodically adjusts. So I kind of don't get where the fire is.
I'd like to remind everybody here in the room that we are taking questions, and there are index cards being passed around. We do have a drop dead of 10 after the hour. So don't hesitate. If there is something you'd like us to address, don't wait. Let us know. Couple of elephants in the room this morning. Oh, yes, John, you have a question, John Reyes?
Oh, and your last remark was, you don't understand where the fire is? I mean, I can think of two Bay Area papers that have lost, one lost $100 million a year in revenue in the course of a couple of years. That's a quarter of its revenue.
Oh, yeah, they have a problem, clearly. I just don't understand why everyone's fire is. Just figuring that out now. I mean, house already burnt down.
Come on. I think you asked where the fire is now. I think the problem
people are standing out on the front lawn scratching their heads saying, gee, should we call the fire department? A little late, guys.
I remember in 1997, I was at a meeting, and I don't know if Steve may have been at this too, in which it was at the Mercury News. I was a department head, and it was the first, and they called the meeting because they recognized a situation which Cisco, for the first time, wanted to buy ads, but only online. As the first, this was 12 years ago, and we walked out of that, and we came to the conclusion that we couldn't do it any other way. And we walked out of the building, and Ann Hurst, if you remember Ann Hurst, said, "Gee, why do I have the feeling I've just seen the beginning of the end?" So it was recognized then that this was a problem, but when you add the kind of the confluence of the needs of Wall Street and the needs of newspapers to maintain a certain profit margin against the fact that online advertising is what, one-tenth of print advertising, you see what newspapers faced, and they really tried to address it in many respects. They just weren't able to do it in time. You add to that a one-off recession, and you see this acceleration towards the bottom that was somewhat unforeseen, and I think that's where the fire is.
Yeah, but
I think it's much more nuanced than newspapers are idiots.
I think the fire was, you know, at that meeting with Cisco. Like, that's when the fire was. And, you know, if you're just figuring out how to rebuild the building now, again, it's a problem.
Okay, Owen, I have a question for you since you're on a roll here, and it comes from the audience, and I encourage your participation. And it's really one of the reasons you're here today. What role does hyperlocal or local journalism play in the next generation of media? Will more mainstream pubs, networks, et cetera, expand and acquire and ramp up in local? And before you answer, it was announced today that the Washington Post killed one of their local efforts, where they were trying to serve Loudoun County in Virginia, and they lost their shirt and they finally quit. So go ahead, have fun with it.
Well, Sam, you were asking earlier, what's the difference between News 1.0 and News 2.0? For me, it's that in News 1.0, you chose your audience. In News 2.0, the audience chooses you. What does it mean to have a local media in News 1.0? It means that you are a TV station broadcasting out of a tower somewhere for, you know, a 100-mile radius or whatever, depending on the geography. If you're a newspaper, it means that you distribute to these, you know, 6-7 counties, whatever, based around one metropolitan city. That's you choosing your audience. And then you serve up that audience a package, often helped by John's organization, of local and national and international news. Local media really wasn't local in 1.0. It was a smorgasbord. And in 2.0, what you have is increasingly, if you want to have a local site, you have to have local content. You define your audience by the content you produce rather than assuming your audience is in a certain geography and producing whatever content you pick for them.
But not to disturb your sleep, mm-hmm. But how do you make money at that? I mean, sub shops are only going to give you $50. Go ahead, Louis.
If I can jump in. I mean, this whole hyperlocalism idea, which I think is a terrific idea. How do you engage people at a very local level in the news and in their communities and use the portals of these mainstream media outlets? That was the idea. But it hasn't worked yet. That doesn't mean to say somebody won't invent the model, but the fact that the Washington Post, that invested millions of dollars in this Loudoun County experiment, they brought the top guy, the guru, Rob Curley, to actually do this, and it's apparently, I thought it was already dead, but apparently they've now officially pulled the plug. I think that raises questions about this whole hyperlocal strategy.
I didn't say hyperlocal. I said local, and it's a very fair question. What's the ideal size? What's the kind of chunk of geography of content? Of what demographics? What psychographics do you pick off? I don't think I grew up one county over from Loudoun County. I don't think there's enough news in Loudoun County. Sorry, for you know, a website, for a section of a newspaper. It's just not that big a story. Now, something for like Northern Virginia, which has historically been served by D.C.-based media organizations, that would be really interesting. Someone ought to do a media product just for Northern Virginia, which is a bigger employment center than Washington, D.C.
Yeah. All I'm saying is there's a lot of experimentation going on. One of the things we are seeing is that there's now a lot of interest, particularly in foundations, in more in-depth investigative reporting of the kind that, you know, we're going to be doing at California Watch. We just received grants from the Irvine Foundation, the Knight Foundation, and the Hewlett Foundation to do in-depth investigative reporting. And is a tremendous, I think people are now saying, okay, if we're going to invest our money, are we going to invest it in local, hyper-local reporting, or reporting that's going to have more of an impact on policy and the world? And I see the Knight Foundation just announced a big investigative reporting initiative. So there's a lot of experimentation going around, and I see now a bit of the pendulum swinging from the local and however we define it, hyper-local or more regional-local, to an interest in substantive journalism.
Lisa Stone of a blogger. Shouldn't localities decide what's news for them and produce it among themselves instead of commercial paratroopers being dropped into their neighborhoods?
Commercial paratroopers. That's a great phrase.
Can I hire some of those? Those sound great.
That's right. I should say, you know, I'm very excited about Irvine Watch, Louis. I think it's a great opportunity to really partner with the community in Irvine. I think that, you know, back to the web 1.0 to 2.0, if web 1.0 was putting out a beautiful glossy magazine or a beautiful newspaper and trying to recruit readers, web 2.0, you go to the community you're trying to serve and you ask them what news is of interest. You ask them what's valuable. And so with an Irvine Watch or a a Virginia watch or a Northern Virginia watch, the opportunity to go to the community and learn that actually it would be incredibly valuable if school district lunch programs were available in the same site where you're talking about traffic closures and the closing of local battered women's shelters. If you could work with the community to survey them and get them to help you develop the content, the likelihood for success is much greater. I can tell you that's one of the reasons that in Bloggers Network we made the decision to cover women in small business and women in entrepreneurship in addition to things like parent blogging and food, because they really wanted both in the same place.
You know what Henry Ford said? If I'd asked the people what they wanted, they would have said they wanted a faster horse.
That's a great industrial metaphor, Quentin, but the reality is online, if you've actually
ask
run a website.
Steve Jobs how often he asks the public what
they
want.
Right. But if you actually run a website, what you know is that your audience is every second of the day telling you not what they think they want in like some kind of market survey fashion, but what they actually want, what they click on, what stories are viewed. That's incredible.
Oh, we watch the crowd. Clicks matter. I'm just sure that taste isn't, you know, you're saying taste will be extinguished. There won't be a market in editorial judgment. I just think there will be.
I don't know if folks are saying that. I mean, clearly when you design your website or you come up with a story, you base it part on your intuition and insight that you offer yourself, and you base it partially on data. I don't know if anyone on this panel is saying it's either or exclusively.
But I guess the question is, are you prepared to question your own taste? Are you prepared to look at this data and actually say, some of my assumptions were wrong, and I better try something else?
When did people not do that?
Yeah, why wouldn't? Why would not?
When did that not happen?
I don't know. I would say for most of the history of the modern media industry over the past couple decades.
Anybody here ever like use a focus group, survey marketing? Stuff didn't sell, you stopped selling it. I mean, things have accelerated. I'm just not sure they've changed dramatically.
Okay, we've got 20 minutes left. On to the next question. I'm sorry, Lewis. I'd like to direct this to both John and Quentin. And Quentin, you cannot say Forbes, okay? Sure. What do you think is the best example of a mainstream media organization evolving to keep pace with the changing media landscape? Either John or Quentin, whoever is more prepared.
Well, at the risk of self-aggrandizement, I would say that we're doing a pretty good job.
Okay, exempt yourself. Look at somebody else. You have customers, too.
You're asking me to... It's the one I know best, but I'll disallow it.
Come on.
Yeah.
I have to say where I go every day is the New York Times.
Yeah, and I'm doing beautiful
But the context of the question is adapting, integrating all these new tools while not sinking the ship as it exists today. Who's doing the best job of transitioning...
Well,
anybody.
I think that virtually every mainstream legacy media is struggling with this issue, that this divide between old media and new media doesn't exist, because virtually every media outlet has their websites, they're doing podcasts, they're doing videocasts, they got the social networks going, but all to a greater or lesser extent. You know, I agree that the New York Times, which has the most resources, is actually quite far along in this process. They have many videographers. They're able to experiment.
NPR is doing much more than most.
And NPR.
But NPR
also
doesn't have to change its business model either.
Wrong.
Yes, they totally do.
How?
I read it in Fast Company in April. The problem is that they're podcasting everything. You go to iTunes, the top five podcasts are NPR. Right? Content. Right. And the affiliates, WGBH in Boston, the other people are saying, hey, you're killing me, right?
So here's what's happening. We're discussing who has the best content, but we need to overlay with another dimension, which is the fundamental accelerating shift in user behavior. And that's where I think NPR has married best of breed, as good as Forbes, as good as AP content, with a shift in the way users want to consume their excellent news. So they've got now these 5-minute podcasts that I can, if I'm at the breakfast table, I can pull in, or I can plug them into my at-home entertainment unit if I have an iPhone, or I can pull them up on Twitter for their alerts. They're actually meeting me everywhere I'm going. And when we did our annual Women in Social Media survey, we asked women, what are you doing less of? and we compared it to last year, and we have found a fundamental acceleration in the number of women who say they are watching less TV, reading fewer newspapers, reading fewer magazines. There is less of a decline in radio, but the most important thing is, I can tell you because we watch them like hawks, they are accelerating their consumption of news about the economy, news about business, news about politics. It is really important to appreciate that there is a huge appetite out there, and well-known brands like the ones on this panel that can meet us where we're going are going to win.
That's one of the astonishing things in media culture generally in the past decade or so is if you look at what's steering the culture or what's famous, nonfiction and the analysis of nonfiction is an incredible source of entertainment to people the way it wasn't before. I mean, think of a sort of great novel everyone's talking about or seems a sign of our times, compared to The World is Flat or Freakonomics or something like that, you know, just to take book publishing as an example. So, you know, yay NPR. But people say they're consuming less. Do you think they actually are? Are they just snacking and it aggregates to the same amount? They're taking it in smaller and smaller bites.
Are they consuming more media overall but less of these older forms?
So you don't sit with 3 hours of TV, but you watch what adds up to 3.25 hours of video over the course of a day maybe.
Owen has nailed it, which is that they are accelerating their use of media. It is the format and the mediums in which they are using it. They still want the very best market analysis they can find, but they're not going to touch it when they read it. They're going to download it.
But okay, the good news is there's more media.
Yeah. I'm afraid I'm going to have to take a stronger hand here because time is ticking and we have wonderful questions from the audience, and I like to prioritize them. Here's one. What does it mean for our collective future if people only read, listen to, and listen to news and opinion that they agree with? Will that lead to greater societal division and less common ground? Anybody? Kevin?
Is that the future we think will happen or not?
That's implicit in the question.
I think we should find those people and we should yell at them until they agree with us.
So, yeah. So actually, Sam, can we do a show of hands on how many people agree with that
statement?
We
can, and I'll for the radio audience, okay. I'll describe the outcome.
All right. So you want to repeat the question?
What does it mean for our collective future if people only read, listen to, and watch news and opinion that they agree with? Will it lead to greater societal division and less common ground? How many people agree with that statement? Raise a hand. So I'd say maybe about half. What about people who disagree with it? So it's maybe two-thirds, one-third agreeing with that statement that media is polarizing and sort of sending people into comfortable places.
I actually don't think that will happen. I think it will happen in pockets and at different points in someone's life it may happen, but overall, I don't think it will happen. If you take a look at, say, The Economist, right, or the FT, those are two media publications that are doing very, very well against this trend of everyone just focusing on news that fits their views. So I actually don't think that will happen on a consistent or long-term basis. It certainly will happen on pockets, but not overall. And people are much too smart for that, I think.
I draw encouragement from two things. One is that YouTube is now the second largest search engine. People are rabidly searching for what they're interested in. And if the market falls, they search. They search Blogger. They might even search their favorite mommy blog for that topic if they know she's likely to cover it. But the second thing is we have in the United States, and thank God, a First Amendment-trained readership. And I know that sometimes they frustrate us. I know they do for me as an editor. But I think this is a group of people who inherently questions. We're a group of individualists. And even our favorite columnist is eventually going to anger us and make us turn to somebody else.
Yeah, and relatedly, let me give a plug for the AP since John couldn't do it himself. So AP is one of our most successful partners on YouTube. They literally have about 25,000 videos uploading, you know, tens of videos a day and generating like hundreds of thousands of views. I can't disclose the specifics. In AP, right, you wouldn't categorize this particularly secular or biased.
Yeah, being nonpartisan is very much, being straight down the middle is very much part of the AP culture.
Yeah. So again, I can understand the concern of the person who asked the question, but based on the data I see and just my faith in people, I'm not that worried about that eventuality.
I tend to agree with Lisa and Kevin. I think it will happen, but it will happen in transition, as people transition to ways to rank, as Lisa talked about.
I think it's not media's job to persuade people of a point of view that they don't want to be persuaded of. I mean, which is basically what we're saying here, is that media ought to go educate those people who disagree with me, so that they agree with me. And it just come on, that's not going to happen. If someone doesn't want to hear other points of view, what, are they going to change their mind because they're exposed to other media? We're talking about them choosing not to expose themselves to, you know, to other points of view. So that's their ultimately their problem.
Right. Oh, and I got to take it to the mat. I'm sorry. Last October,
you wrote... You go and yell at those people.
No, last October, you wrote a story that you published on Ballywag saying that the Forbes Bureau was going to get shut down, Betsy Corcoran was going to stab me in the back, and I was going to be out of work. You didn't call Betsy, and you didn't call me. Why didn't you want your point of view challenged?
And, you know, I would say go to Ballywag.com, read the actual story, because Quentin's distorting it because he takes
it
a little personally.
You didn't call me. You didn't call me. How do I get that wrong? For those on the radio, awkward. I'm sure you got a lot of clicks. You just didn't ask for comment.
No, you know
so
what?
So much for both points of view.
Biggest mistake at Ballywag was ever writing about Forbes because it bores the heck out of the audience. I know.
That may be entertaining, but you chose to write a story without checking the facts.
It's time for the next question. Which is, has to do with social media. But we can take this outside afterwards.
You may have to.
What do the panelists think about the impact of real-time services such as Twitter on the future shape of reporting news? I'd like to start with Lewis on this.
I think this is a central point, is that whatever new journalism model evolves is going to involve an integration of old media tools, like solid journalism, and using all these social media tools. And I totally agree with Lisa that we're going to have to engage the audience much more than the mainstream media have done over the years because the technology exists, and I think it will enhance what we can do enormously. So it's totally an integral part of any new journalism model that evolves.
Do you think that the rank-and-file journalists who grew up in the 80s and 90s understand what those tools are? There was an incident in May of this year where Bill Keller, executive editor of New York Times, had an internal meeting about where they ought to go collectively, and three or four reporters were sitting in the meeting tweeting about what was being discussed, and by the time the meeting was over, Keller had a fit. It's like, what are you doing? Right? I mean, there's insidiousness to these tools. Yes, Lisa.
I have to just jump in really quickly there and say that just like with any communications technology, a news organization needs to come up with rules whereby its employees use those tools. Okay, so we're sitting here in Silicon Valley with a group of communications experts who all, I'm sure, have it. Their own blogging policies. And for Twitter, which is a group chat, for those of you who have never been to twitter.com, it's a way to share with a group of people 140 characters about some news item, whether it's what you ate for lunch or what you just heard President Obama say.
These are trained journalists. Wouldn't they know better?
Well, actually, trained journalists are trained to tell the news. And if there wasn't a policy in place, that's really where there's a challenge, I think. But I will say that the role of Twitter is a little bit like, you know, the paper boy on the street corner 100 years ago saying, extra, extra, hear all about it, and telling you the one line before you went home to turn on your favorite radio show or to pick up your Evening Post. So I do believe technology can be used for good, Sam. I see it done every day.
Well, you actually raise a really good point, Lisa, which is that the paperboy who was yelling extra, extra was trying to sell you a paper. And the problem with Twitter is that we now have all the paperboys out there yelling extra, extra, and there's no paper to sell on Twitter.
But I subscribe to the New York Times Twitter feed and the NPR Twitter feed, and they sell me stories that way.
True. And, you know, and we've gone to a world where instead of wholesaling a package of stories, we're retailing stories one at a time. And, you know, again, that goes to your earlier point about people segmenting them off. Well, they're not just segmenting themselves off on based on point of view. They're segmenting themselves off on interest. And if your content is not interesting to them, they're going to ignore it. It doesn't, you know, have to be a philosophical thing. You're just not commanding their attention.
A question for Kevin. You represent a video medium. Do you feel that people drag their eyeballs over text less and less these days? and people want to experience their media as opposed to consume it with words?
I think they complement each other. I think all of us have probably found videos on YouTube and then done a search on Google or on the web to read more about what they saw on YouTube.
Do you think that, or do you know it from research?
I believe that anecdotally it's true, and I don't want to do another show of hands, but I believe that anecdote probably resonates with a lot of people in the room. Likewise, you know, the ecosystem works the other way too, where you read an article, right, and that article often links to a video, and you watch the video to get to understand the story or the perspective in fuller glory. So for me, those are not complementary. I guess I'm in an optimistic mood today, but it really is another one of those times where the pie expands and they both feed off each other. And that's from the user point of view. From a journalist or a reporter point of view, I would imagine, or a blogger, I imagine having easy access to video, whether on YouTube, right, or another site, makes your job in a certain way a lot easier, right? You have material that's much more easily accessible. Your users will engage in your blog post or story more, and it just makes your, you know, it's easier to build an audience and to really be creative.
Next question, everybody. The basic question in News 2.0 has to do with credibility. How do independent bloggers and social media establish that their perspectives and data are, in fact, true? Lisa.
Well, I think every blogger has to figure that out for themselves, but I can tell you that in 2005, when we started working with the blogger community, we decided to publish some editorial guidelines that we were interested in upholding on our new service about what women were blogging online. And we put up the basic tenets of journalism that I was trained to use as a print reporter and then in broadcast. Everything from following the Electronic Frontier Foundation.org's guide to fair use, to anti-plagiarism, anti-third-party copyright infringement. You have to credit your source. You have to link your source, whether it's a photograph or an illustration, et cetera, et cetera. And then we added an extra dollop, which was we don't want to have conversations on our site about news of any kind that include hate mail or harassment, anything that doesn't promote civil disagreement, because we're very pro First Amendment, but if you say something that's hate mail or harassment, we're going to ask you to go. And so that's what we recommend for our bloggers, and I think every community has to come up with their own.
Does it bother you when we hear reports that these consumer bloggers are getting free products and trips, and that would never happen in either John's world or Lewis's. What? Never happened.
That's actually also forbidden in our guidelines. Yeah. It's not allowed to place anything in the editorial well for which you've been paid cash or received goods in kind. It's part of our guidelines.
But won't that self-policing diminish the integrity or the perception of integrity of organic media, for the lack of a better word?
Sam, the great thing is that bloggers like to blog about nothing more than bloggers and blogging. So the self-policing is, you know, is well enforced. I take as an example the well-known blogger Julia Allison, who went on a paid-for junket to SeaWorld, and that was all over the blogosphere instantly, that she'd been paid for that. So, you know, I think it does, you know, it does actually police itself to a very large extent, because people are really interested in this question as they're...
And I think the problem of truth in the blogosphere reflects a larger problem of truth in the society in general. You know, when you could have something like death panels in healthcare reform, which is everybody agrees that this isn't in the legislation, but somehow this death panel idea still has credibility and is still part of the discourse. And it's not, you can't blame all of that on the bloggers.
No, you can't. It's interesting because I think that, and this is why I keep referring to blogging technology as a tool like a printing press, you have to earn the reader's trust, and you can lose it in a heartbeat. I think that if you offend, if you take the death panel example, and you, you know, are more interested in sharing what ex-Governor Sarah Palin has to say about death panels than you are about sharing where people can actually read the legislation online, you know, there are certain readers you're going to lose instantaneously.
I think there's a kind of troubling, the problem here in a way is that there's a bias around it's online or it's, you know, print, it's internet or it's not internet, you know. Maybe everything disappears into the internet, but that kind of flies in the face of the history of communications. Western Union sent its last telegram 3 years ago, and now it sends money orders. That's still a kind of information going over wires. It's actually very, very hard to find a communications medium that disappeared outright. Stereoscopic slides is the only one I can find. And newspapers have been around successfully for centuries. They may be in smaller in circulation. Print may have a different kind of valence or meaning to people, but I'm not sure this idea that like everything is going to go on the blog and on the internet and be this way is exactly accurate. I think different media will have probably different kind of psychological representations to people. And, for example, you mentioned The Economist. The Economist kind of runs away from the internet in much of its presentation. They have a website, but they're very much a hard magazine to read, and that's what they're fronting. You go there for analysis, and people choose that. For most, the real problem we're discussing here in terms of the craziness and the surrealism of a lot of the media now has to do with the overall onslaught of media, both online and offline. And the problem there is that there's too much of everything, so there's a temptation to punch hard, to be Rush Limbaugh, or to be Daily Kos, to really, you know, punch through with a strong opinion, a super strong point of view that rises above the generalized flow. And people do latch onto that. And so on both sides, they grab on the deaf panel and they throw that around because that'll get you the clicks. That'll get you read. And also it speaks to us as somewhat rational but largely irrational creatures to seize on the emotional moment and not spend the time doing the hard work. That's kind of a long-winded way of saying, you know, how good any of these media are depends on how good we are.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have time for one more question, and we're going to ask it of every panelist. But I really want to thank the folks here in Mountain View, California, for submitting excellent questions. We wish we had time for them all. John Race of AP, I'm going to ask you first. And if each of you would once again identify yourself for the radio audience. Let's imagine it's August 2014, 5 years from now. We were to reconvene. We're talking about news. I don't know. Let's say it's 4.0 by then. What's the world going to be like, assuming you're still at AP and you're wrestling with just simply modernized challenges from what you're dealing with today? What will news be like 5 years from now?
Well, I'm on the optimistic side of the table here. I see optimism on the small scale for newspapers. I don't agree with Rupert Murdoch that newspapers are going to be gone in 20 years. I think in 5 years we're going to see a stabilization in the advertising market, and that there won't be huge growth, and there may be a real decimation of regional metros, but we'll still have newspapers. I think that mobile is going to take off. In 5 years from now, we'll have a profitable mobile network, and that's going to be very interesting as far as the forms of journalism, because mobile tends to, you know, collect a certain type of news. In fact, it's a type of news that we've done for a long time. And so we'll have a separation. We'll have niche products. You're seeing, and you may not know it now, but you're seeing this kind of change in newspapers now where they're going to either the free model, or they're going to a kind of a niche product that has a great deal of depth and context to it. I think from my own perspective, I think much has been said, not here, but recently, about protection, paywalls. You may not know this if you're familiar with paywalls and newspapers, that there are already lots of papers, some of my papers that I visit, who have been operating with paywalls for years. I think we're going to see some form of, we're going to see that, and I think we'll see some settling in that within 5 years or so.
This is Kevin Yen of YouTube. I have two predictions. The first is, in 5 years when this panel reconvenes here, the people who are experimenting today and determined and learning and have the creativity and talent will be telling people in the audience how it was and how challenging it was and how they developed and developed the new successful models. The second prediction is that, this isn't going out on a limb, but that Quentin and Owen will be buddies.
We were buddies before. He just fell down, but you've learned.
You know, Quentin, I'm glad you're here and the knife wounds are
Radio
healing.
Radio folks, we're shaking hands.
I have a question back for John. How many employees at the Associated Press today?
There are about 3,600 employees. 3,000 of them are journalists.
5 years from now, how many more? Less?
I would say we will probably be at roughly the same number. We're a not-for-profit, about 25% and slipping of our revenue comes from newspapers, which has to be met by revenue coming from other areas. I don't see us growing hugely. I don't see us dropping.
What's YouTube itself going to look like in 5 years, subsumed into Google?
Hopefully it continues to be what it is today, but bigger in giving users even more choice than is available today, whether that's entertainment content, news content, individual opinions. So just more of what it is today, but bigger.
YouTube started as a search engine for cool video, but it's becoming a little bit more packaged. Maybe before we wind up, you can address that a little bit so that Google will have a few more billboards, watch this, watch that, sort of a guide for what is on YouTube today.
Sam, so I think what you're referring to is YouTube maybe introducing more of a programmed element into the user experience. Today, as you may know, many people, when they come to YouTube to watch, they begin by searching for videos, and then they click on the videos that show up in the results. So it's very much a search-driven experience. What we're experimenting with YouTube is more of a programmed element so that we begin to editorially like surface content and package and program content to the users. We believe we can add value to users there instead of relying just on search and just on algorithms. Three nascent areas that were developing that navigational or programming element is for news, youtube.com/news/music/shows. So presuming our experiments work well there and we create value for users, you know, partners and advertisers, you'll see us continue to invest in a programmed element to complement our algorithmic driven results.
Okay, Lisa Stone, blogger.
Thanks, Sam. Crucial to what Blogger has become over the past 4.5 years has been a curated, edited experience. On Blogger.com, we have today 79 different editors plus 25 specialists whose job it is every week to go out and tell us what's hot in their beat. What are women in social media doing in everything from politics to parenthood? We think that no matter what the latest gadget is, whether it's a Kindle or it's the new iPhone, that input from people you trust is going to matter increasingly in what kinds of news you consume on any topic. So I think the killer app, we still think the killer app will be tools, algorithm-based tools, that users who develop trust with readerships can use to recommend the top content, news, and expertise of the day. I don't think the human element is going away. In fact, as I said before, I think it's the golden age of communications, and it's more important than ever. But I also think it's important to remember that today's news telling is a conversation. You really have to work with your user to ask them what they think and to continue the dialogue, because it turns out no matter how good you are at your beat, your story, your subject matter, there's always going to be someone out there reading you who's a PhD-level expert who can actually open your own mind. And that's the thing that we talk to our editors about at Blogger.com.
Quentin Hardy, it's August 2014. Are you still at Forbes? Is there a Forbes?
I may or may not be at Forbes, but many, many things will not have changed. We started up by talking about news 1.0, but we talked about the 19th century. The news business goes much earlier than that. And if you look at the first English language newspaper, it's in the 16th century. And there on the front page is a big woodcut of a flood with a bunch of corpses floating around in it and some cows who have drowned, and it's like really sensationalist. And that was, you know, basically sort of free to the masses. There'd be some ads or whatever in it, and maybe they'd sell it for a penny.
And they didn't call anyone.
Yeah, and they didn't. Thanks, Owen. And yeah, they didn't have phones, Owen. You did. And and on the other side, there were letters from Europe that were circulated on a subscription basis. People would, you know, come to London, collect the latest news, and sell this on a subscription basis to rich and powerful people who either wanted to know about the world or were planning their political or mercantile futures. Those are two business models that have been around for centuries. I'm not sure they're going away. You've had pamphleteers, where guys would issue their, you know, pay somebody to issue their public view. I'm not sure that model goes away. Some of these tweak, they get adapted, but that's not going. What's interesting to me, and I'll keep it short, is markets work off scarcity, not really abundance. People find things that are valuable and scarce and supply them. In a digital world, what's really scarce, it's kind of interesting to see, is human contact. I mean, you all took the trouble to come down here and see us today. I love you, radio viewer, listeners, too. You know, music is free, but YouTube can charge $300. YouTube charges $300 a ticket now. MIT has all of its courses online. I don't see them cutting their tuition. You know, actual human moments, authenticity, feeling something amid this digital blur, that's going to be incredibly valuable now and even more in the future.
Thank you, Quentin. 2 minutes, Owen Thomas.
I think what you're going to see in 5 years is many more media organizations, generally much smaller. And, you know, the imperial newsrooms of the regional metros with 400, 500 journalists and no idea what they're all doing, those will be well gone. I think what you're also going to see is, to echo what Lisa and Quentin are saying, is journalists who are trained to engage their audience in the actual production of the news, where you don't just create a package of news and, you know, deliver it to their door, but the stories evolve and they're informed by your audience, and you take that back and you put out more stories, and it keeps going in a cycle that that binds your audience to you tighter and tighter because they know that they're a part of the news.
So you really think that like the New York Times is not going to be around in 5 years?
No, but I think the New York Times is going to be much more tightly bound to its audience. I mean, you already see it in San Francisco, where, you know, a lot of people in sort of my cohort don't subscribe to the Chronicle, but they do subscribe to the New York Times because they feel more connected to this paper 3,000 miles away. I find that really interesting and telling.
Louis Friedberg.
Well, a lot's going to depend on what's going to happen in the economy in the next year or two. That will really shape the long-term future of newspapers. I think in 5 years there are going to be many more or several more nonprofit journalism models. This may be wishful thinking, but supported by foundations and philanthropists and venture capitalists, many of whom live here in Silicon Valley, like California Watch. Right now, California Watch has about 8 reporters. I'm hoping in 5 years we'll have 25, 30 reporters around the state. And I'm going to predict that in 5 years, half the people in this room will be reading newspapers on iPhones or Prees or Storms, and that you'll be paying for it as part of your monthly cell phone bill.
I had a question regarding the primacy of what we grew up believing media to be. A former White House Chief of Staff, Andy Card, once famously said that the media is just another special interest group, no more nor less than any other lobbying, self-absorbed organization. Do you feel like future generations will look at media with the divinity that a lot of us regarded it with?
Maybe not, but, you know, Andrew Card was, you know, in the Bush White House, and they did see the media, by and large, as the enemy. And I don't know if media is a special interest group. I think it's...
By the way,
I think it represents
out?
The interest... What was that?
How'd that work out for him?
I'd like to see journalism as an interest group representing the interests of the American people. It may not always work out exactly that way, but without that interest group, I think we would be far worse off as a society.
I think if you and your audience form a single interest group, then you'll be in pretty good shape.
John, do you have anything to add to this, since you preside over three states of Associated Press, Hawaii, Northern Cal, and...
Well, in regards to the earlier question, I do think, I mean, Andrew Card was looking at that from his own perspective, which you have a group of White House correspondents who are jockeying for position all the time and doing all the things that people do when they're trying to get an interview. So I think that's kind of a skewed perspective. I think this view of reporters, there's been kind of a love-hate skeptical view of reporters. Think of the big story back in the early 50s, about the, which was really about the cynicism of journalism. And that's a 50-year-old, 55-year-old meme. So I think that there will be this. I think it continues, frankly. I don't see a whole lot of difference there. I think people will have a certain amount of skepticism about what we do and who we are. But I also think trusted brands will remain trusted brands. And new trusted brands that grow will come in as well.
Okay, everybody, time to give a big hand to all six panelists.
Thank you, Sam.
And once again, Commonwealth Club's Steve Wright.
In keeping with today's program, I did tweet about it a couple of times. I hope some of the rest of you did, too. Seriously, I hope you all enjoyed today's program, brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and PRSA Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank John Race, Northern California Bureau Chief for the Associated Press, Lisa Stone, co-founder of Blogger, Louis Friedberg, Director of California Watch, Quentin Hardy, Manager of the Silicon Valley Bureau of Forbes, Kevin Yen, Director of Strategic Partnerships at YouTube, Owen Thomas of NBC Bay Area, and Sam Whitmore, founder of Sam Whitmore's Media Survey. I'd also like to thank you, the audience, and I'd like to thank those of you joining us on radio today. This meeting is adjourned.